Hello, and welcome to the Hull Libraries podcast. In this episode, we had a chat with local writer Louise Beach. She has 6 books published so far, including some inspired by fascinating events from her friends and family's real lives, as you'll discover during the course of our conversation. Head over to her website, louisebeach.co.uk, for full details on all of her books, as well as old newspaper columns and lots of other tidbits from her career. So we had a fun and engaging chat with Louise about what it's like to actually be a writer after dreaming of becoming one since childhood, how to navigate mining your real life for inspiration, and how it's more important to write what you feel than what you know. So put on your coat and walking boots, or settle back with a warm cuppa and enjoy our chat with the ace, Louise Beach.
When I was a very young child, because I kind of made stories up in my head before I could even physically write with a pen and before I even knew the alphabet, it was kind of an escape. I just often like going into these other worlds that I created, partly maybe just because I was a very imaginative child. I had quite a tough upbringing, quite a disruptive household, and I think some of it was escape as well, a little bit maybe of therapy even at that young age, and just sort of being able to create exactly the stories that I enjoy, if that makes sense. So the kind of things that I like to read, I wrote those things. As soon as I could write them down, I would fill exercise books, I would have a contents page, I would draw the pictures, and it just made me really happy right from the start.
So what sort of things were you reading as a child? What was it that was firing your imagination and you thinking, oh, I'd like to do that?
As a young child, I loved some of the older classic books like Heidi by Joanna Spyri, What Katie Did. I did like the Famous Five adventure things. And then as I got older, my reading was a little bit ahead of my age. So by the time I was 12, I was reading Geoffrey Archer and Jackie Collins and Stephen King, hidden away under the bed covers, you know, with the torch, not supposed to be reading those things. Because I was just so hungry to read. And I think it was the one thing I was good at where I was, you know, ahead of my age. But basically, I would read anything. If I was in a house and there was a bookshelf and there was something to read, I would give it a go.
It's one of the interesting things about books. You almost can and are sometimes even encouraged to read above your age in a way that people can be a bit, I don't know, reticent about films or games or other things that might have graphic content. You can easily sneak in a book. And I remember reading kind of horror books when I was a similar age. And, you know, they've got some pretty full-on stuff in them, but you're just devouring it. It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, you're right, actually. Thinking of the content of some of those books, I'm not sure I'd want my, say, 12-year-old reading those. And yet, it certainly didn't damage me. Well, maybe I should leave that for people who know me to decide on that.
I guess a kind of follow-up question then is, seeing as you always wanted to be a writer from a really young age, is it everything you hoped it would be now you've actually achieved that dream of being a writer? Is it what you envisioned as a small child, or is it different?
That's a really good question. That genuinely is. I don't think I've been asked that one quite like that before. Is it what I thought? It is as wonderful as I thought it would be to see the things that I've written in actual physical books, you know, in the Kindle form. That bit is exactly as exciting as I anticipated it would be. Oh gosh, that is such a thought-provoking question. I suppose a lot of people dream that it'll bring them great wealth and fame, and you end up a little bit grounded in that regard because, you know, unless you're literally Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, it's not an income that changes your life necessarily. So I think I would advise a younger writer than myself to, you know, go into it level-headed. Yeah, the editing process has been interesting because obviously then you have to let someone else put their fingers in your pie, so to speak, and accept that they may see a different vision for your book. So you've got to open yourself up to that, be prepared to take that on. But it is everything that I hope for. Yes, I would say it is.
I guess the reason I thought of that question to ask is I was kind of pondering before we started this that, again, you know, talking about you wanting to be a writer from a young age. If you'd asked me what I wanted to do when I was, say, 7, I probably would have said I want to be a writer or an author, because the idea of just spending all day dreaming up stories would have been perfect. But as an adult, that wouldn't be something I'd want to do. So I guess that's why I was wondering about and asking if your experience as an adult and your experience as a child is sort of different, because what you want to do as a child isn't necessarily for everyone what you're good at as an adult or what you'd want to do. But obviously it makes an amazing story if the thing you want to do as a child is the thing you end up doing and you do genuinely love it.
Yeah, and I've discovered, thinking now, there's so much more to it than just the writing, because obviously as a child, you just picture yourself in this romantic study, maybe with views out of the window, typing away, creating stories. The writing aspect of it is probably literally 30% of the job, because there is obviously promoting, editing, doing book events, writing articles about the book for, you know, maybe newspapers or magazines. There's so much else that goes into it that you possibly don't think of when you're dreaming of your book being on a shelf. But luckily, I love all those things. I do love doing this kind of thing, these podcasts. I love talking about the book. I love doing library events. I've done some fabulous library events over the years. I think if you didn't enjoy those things, you actually wouldn't like being a writer. I really do.
Editing's an interesting one. You've mentioned it a few times. I'm sort of imagining it's one of those things that people who dream of being writers, that doesn't really figure in their process of like, oh, I'm going to have to get someone else to read this and then they're going to kind of hack it to bits. You imagine you probably just write something and hand it in and then they go, oh, brilliant, we'll publish that then.
You know what, it'd be wonderful if that was the case, but you're absolutely right. But people who edit for a job, for example, they've learned that skill and they're good at, you know, they might restructure certain chapters. They might think that a certain scene needs to come earlier. They may think you're over-embellishing that part, not so much that. Just little things that you can't see as a writer because you're in the thick of it, you're in the full of it, and it's hard to step out and look in with detached eyes because obviously you feel it and you're emotional about your book. And you do sometimes have to make yourself be a little detached and be quite harsh when you edit it yourself before, you know, your editor then has their go. But I have learned to do that. I am self-critical. I do push myself and I'm a perfectionist, so that does help, yeah.
So what was it like, the kind of first experience of having a book kind of edited for you? And I mean, I don't know how it works. Does it sort of come back with a load of notes and a load of big crosses through bits going, get rid of this bit, move this bit somewhere else, this bit's good, this bit's rubbish? How does it work?
Yes and no. Not quite the this bit's rubbish. I think they're a little bit more diplomatic than that.
You would hope so.
But yes, it does come back. Your Word document comes back to you with lines in the margin and they'll highlight certain parts. And it's suggested rather than that you have to do it. And you are allowed to argue against certain suggestions. There might be something you actually don't agree with and think, no, I really want to keep this bit. And you can argue your case. But I'll be honest, 90% of the time, the edits, they do make good suggestions and I do change them. But yeah, that's exactly how it comes back. It's a document. I wouldn't use the word butchered because that's not fair, because because I don't see it as being ruined, if you know what I mean. Enhanced, shall we say?
Is it a difficult process then? Because I would imagine, you know, you've been kind of working on this little private thing for a long time, or I don't know, you're the sort of writer that shows things to friends and family as you're going along, or do you kind of keep it to yourself? And if so, you've then got to kind of unleash it onto to someone else and then for it to come back and it be, well, this is good, but can we change that? Is this difficult or is that something you enjoy?
First of all, to answer the question about whether my friends and family read, yes, I have a couple of close family and friend members who I trust enough to give it to when it's raw and it's just written. And I have a couple of writer friends who I trust enough to let them read it as well. And they'll just give me a general overview. And, you know, they're not going to do edits in the margin for me. They'll just tell me what maybe does work, doesn't work. And that's good because it gives you an initial idea and you can polish it a bit. But they're not usually particularly harsh, to be fair, because they are your friends, even if you want them to be. So, and then that at least gives you maybe an idea before it does go to your editor as to what may be wrong with it that's going to happen. But no, I quite like the editing process. I do. It's a bit like pruning and fine-tuning and perfecting. So I do like what you end up with, this polished, finished product that is, I suppose, like a sculpture in a way, where it's been chipped away and then you end up with this lovely thing that's maybe smooth and good on the eye.
I mean, I don't know if it's the same thing at all, but certainly, because I edit this podcast as well, there's a weird pleasure in actually removing things. I don't know if you find that same thing. You've kind of made this big, long thing, but then there's a kind of catharsis and release of going, I'm just going to get rid of that whole section, actually. We're going to remove that bit and not include it. It's weirdly satisfying and enjoyable.
I totally agree. Because certain bits will stand out, won't they, where you think, that's great, we need that. And then you might think, that's a bit flowery, we don't need that so much. Yeah.
So we've talked about kind of childhood a bit and always wanting to be a writer. And then obviously now you are a writer, but we've kind of missed out a whole chunk in the middle there, a large glaring chunk of how you get from A to B or A to Z, however we want to do it. So what is the journey into it? I guess there's lots of pit stops along the way and it's not a straightforward.
Yeah. It was a long, 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 long journey. I often get asked what I studied at university, and I didn't go to university. I got pregnant while I was doing the A-levels. My son's now 30, so that's a bit crazy. And I do often think to myself, would the journey have been faster if I'd gone to university? And I guess I'll never know. I will never know that. But basically, being a young single parent sort of set me back a few years because I was busy with that. And then I wrote a column for the Hull Daily Mail for a few years, and that reminded me my love of writing and my passion came back. So then it was in my early 30s when I started writing novels, and my first four novels that I wrote were rejected by every single publisher and literary agent in the UK. So that was over a period of so many years. And so that was quite disheartening, obviously. So then I perfected the short story form and had a few published, won a few competitions, and that gave me my confidence back. So I tried again with the novels. And then finally, in 2015, I did eventually get a book deal with the fourth book that I'd written, which just shows you how long it can take. And my debut was How to Be Brave. And that was obviously therefore by that time, after many, many edits and looking back at it. So yeah, it definitely didn't come easily. And again, I don't know whether that was just because I had to put that kind of life on hold for a bit. I'm not sure, but I'm here now, so I guess that's what matters.
You know, you read about a lot of writers getting rejected time and time again. I guess it's a fairly common for every writer that gets accepted the first time they send a manuscript in, there's plenty that slog away for years. How do you kind of keep going through that period? Because it must be quite disheartening, and there must be times when you think, well, maybe this just isn't for me.
Oh gosh, yeah, it was that the first time I got a rejection, I did just cry my eyes out like a kid. And then I thought, right, Louise, you sort yourself out, you know, you can't be like this every time, because you're probably going to get a lot. So you toughen up a little bit. One of the main things I tried to do was, if it was a rejection where they gave me some advice, I took that on board. And I tried to turn each rejection just into sort of the fire in my heel, so to speak, where I kind of became a little bit defiant, where I just thought, the more you reject me, the harder I'm just going to fight. So that's obviously a good thing, because then you've got all this fire behind you. And I don't know what made me keep going, except that it helped that I love writing. I think if I hadn't loved it and had self-belief, because I did believe it would eventually happen, then I probably would have given up after book one or two, wouldn't I? But there was something in me that just drove me on. But I don't know, I really did believe it would happen. So I guess you've got to have a bit of faith in yourself. Sounds like a bit of a cliche, doesn't it? But that is what kept me going. Yeah.
And so you mentioned, you know, kind of you got pregnant at 19 and that put your life on hold for a little bit. And then the kind of next thing was writing the column for the Hull Daily Mail. How did you, because that's, I imagine a lot of people would love to do that. How did you kind of get into that? Was that sending stuff into them and just hoping they would pick you up? Or did you have a kind of an in, or?
It was exactly what you said. I sent some stuff to them. So basically, I eventually married my current husband, Joe, and we had my daughter, Katie. And I just started writing little funny witty, sort of light-hearted, real-life articles just about being a mum, just the comical things that your kids do. And someone said that they thought they were really good. So I sent them to the editor of what was then the free newspaper, the Advertiser. And he just said, oh, we love these. Do you think you could write something every week? So it started in the free Advertiser, and then the whole Daily Mail spotted it. And then they moved me there. And I wrote it for, in a total of 10 years, every week. And it was really good as a practice for discipline, because it meant I had to write something every week that was 500 words, that was entertaining, you know, and perfect for my audience. So it was just the best discipline in the world. And it now means that I've got this lovely diary, in a way, because I've got them all in a box, of like my children's childhood. So yeah, I would say to anyone who's maybe written things, just be a bit cheeky, send them out, take a chance. You know, if you don't send them out, no one's going to see them.
So that must have been quite thrilling at the time to get offered a sort of weekly column, to be able to do that, kind of coming from, you know, just writing stuff presumably at that point that is sort of, you know, privately, I guess, to suddenly have a newspaper column. That's quite a exciting thing to happen.
It was. I cannot describe the excitement when I first saw the actual column in the newspaper, you know, with my picture and a title and a headline. I was like, wow. I was that's why I kept them all, because I really was so proud. And they taught, and doing that taught me a lot with regards, obviously, the eventual fiction writing. So yeah, it was a very proud moment.
So on your website, I don't know if I've got the phrasing exactly right, but I think you described the newspaper column as provoking a lot of love and hate responses, or words to that effect. And that, yes, that intrigued me a little bit, and I wondered what you meant by that.
People, what's a shame is that when people like something, they're not as vocal about that. You know, they'll think, I like this, but they won't necessarily say anything. But when people don't like something, oh, they're very vocal. And I did get a few letters into the newspaper criticising the column. It was such simple things I got criticised for. I got told that it was twee. Then I got told off one time because I explicitly described some snot, something as simple as that. And then I can't remember any of the other, but I found it odd that people would go to the trouble of writing a detailed letter of criticism rather than praise. So I think I still have some of those criticisms. I'll have to seek them out, won't I? Some were actually quite funny. So yeah, but that toughened me up a bit and prepared me for obviously the eventual book reviews, which also, you know, can be harsh at times.
So yeah, you've kind of written this newspaper column, and then I know a few of your books are kind of inspired by events in your real life. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what it's like to kind of mine your real life to an extent for your kind of work, whether it's back in the newspaper column days, you know, talking about being a mum and sort of everyday family life, and then some of the stuff you've written your books about. Is that, how do you kind of navigate that? Because obviously they say write what you know, and be inspired by things that happen in your life. That's where you're going to get your inspiration from. But then it must be difficult when it's people you know and people you care about. How do you ask permission for people? How do you navigate that and sort of respect boundaries?
The write what you know, I prefer with me, it's write what I feel. As in, because I always think I don't have to necessarily know it, because you can do research. But if you feel passionate about it, I think you can write anything, because the passion will drive you. So for me, write what you feel. That's just my little personal motto. But with regards writing about real life events, I have done that, but in my novels I've turned it into fiction, so then it's like a safe arena to explore these real life events. So for example, How to Be Brave, my debut, that explored a real life situation that happened to me. So basically, my daughter, Katie, when she was 7 years old, she got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which is the random diabetes where they don't know why it happens. Your pancreas just fails and you need multiple blood tests, multiple injections every day. So as you can imagine, for a seven-year-old, it was quite horrific. And when she was about 10, she got very depressed about it all. And she just said to me one day, I just don't want to do it anymore. And we knew what she meant by that, because we knew if she didn't have her injections that she would die within a week. So we had to find a way to persuade her to have her injections, and it was horrific. And we tried everything, you know, blackmail, promises, everything. And in the end, I said to her, what about if I tell you stories while we do the injection to distract you, when I'll do any kind of story you want? So at first she said, great, make something up like Harry Potter. And I'm like, oh my God, how can I make something that good up? You know, I don't write children's stories. So in the end, at the time, I was researching my grandfather's true life war story, because my grandfather, Colin Armitage, he is a local man, and he was lost at sea for 50 days. So he was quite a war hero. He and one other man survived on a lifeboat in the middle of the South Atlantic Sea for 50 days. There had been 14 of them at the start, and when they were finally rescued, there was just two of them. So it's quite a spectacular, you know, story, like an adventure at sea. So I said, how about I tell you that story in installments, because that's your real-life great-grandfather. So she was fascinated, and that was the thing that finally got her to have the injections, if that makes sense. So it was quite miraculous. So afterwards, I thought, wow, that in itself would make a story. You know, a young girl who's ill and an ancestor from the past, she gets his story to make her be brave. What about if there was a bit of time slip in there? But by the time I came to write it, my daughter was 13 and she said, I don't want to be in a novel, mother, it's embarrassing. So I thought, right, okay. So I fictionalised a mum and daughter, but I stuck to the facts when I wrote about my grandfather, if that makes sense. So it's kind of a sort of magic realism, sort of fiction, non-fiction. And I had to do a lot of research about my grandfather to get the facts right, because he's not with us anymore, sadly. I never met him, he died before I was born. So yeah, I had to honour my daughter and not include her as a real life person in that. So I just, it was a different name, a different age, a different scenario, so that, you know, I respected that. So that was tricky. But once I decided it was fiction, that made it easy, because I could do whatever I wanted. So I guess it's easier sometimes if you use real life events to inspire a fictional story. I find that easier rather than sticking exactly with the truth. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, yeah. I was going to ask about your grandfather's story, actually, because I'd read a little bit about that, and it is a really amazing story.
Oh.
Even as those sorts of war stories go, that's a real, I mean, quite a tragic story as well, but an amazing story of survival on his part as well. Like you say, to be one of only two left out of how many it was, you said, 15 or so in the
14. I know. And what's been marvellous about that book is that when it did come out, some other people came forward who had family members on that lifeboat. So I met people I might never have otherwise met as a result of that book. So that's a little bit magic, you know what I mean? Like, sort of, and then hearing the stories they knew about that. So, there was something quite remarkable about doing that. And, yeah, it's an incredible story. It has been covered in this area in our local, you know, news and newspapers, because it is such a big story. So it was nice for me to write it as his granddaughter. I felt quite proud to do that, yeah.
So you said by kind of making the decision to fictionalise a real life, something that was inspired by real life events, makes it a lot easier. Does there come a challenge with that, though, of then when you're writing it, having to kind of second guess yourself a bit and think, oh, is this fictional enough? Or is this kind of too much like the real thing? Do I need to kind of make it more fictional, or does that make it less relatable? It seems, I mean, maybe it's easy, but it seems to me it could be a bit of a minefield.
I think it's more of a minefield if you're doing it with regards to someone else's story, isn't it? Because you have to be respectful to them, you have to honour them. Whereas if it's from something that just happened to me, I'm only answerable to me. So, you know, if I get it wrong, it's just me. So that kind of is what divides it for me. If I'm like writing about my daughter, I had to be super careful. But if it was, something inspired by me. For example, my most recent book, This Is How We Are Human, is inspired by a young autistic man. And so for that, I really, really, it wasn't even my relative, as in that was the trickiest. And so when I wrote that, I met him and his mum, who was a very good friend of mine. We met regularly and we acted scenes out and I listened to how he spoke. And they read the chapters as I went to make sure that I'd done it right, if that makes sense. So that was quite a different experience to anything else I've written, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that book as well, because the kind of premise of that seems quite interesting, and obviously with no spoilers, but I wonder if you could describe what the kind of the setup for that book is.
Okay, in the real world, and I know that my friend Fiona, she's the presenter on BBC Radio Humberside, she won't mind me sharing because we've talked publicly about this. We're both really like vocal about talking about this issue in the book. So we've been friends for some years now. And we met for lunch about 3 years ago and she was really upset. And she just said, I'm having a really hard time with my son, Sean. And Sean was 20 at the time. He's autistic. He's got a twin called Connor. They both are. And young Sean, he was just desperate to meet a girl, you know, have sex, have his first kiss. And he's finding it really tricky because he is on the spectrum and he does have certain quirks that maybe made girls nervous, made it very difficult for him to meet someone. And Fiona just said that the night before, her and her husband had just said off the cuff, not even intending to do this, just as a thought, they said, do we just take him to Amsterdam and pay someone to give him what he wants? And she then straight away said to me, we're not really going to do that. It just came to us. So obviously as a writer, I thought, oh my word, what if someone did do that? So I said this to Fiona after a few weeks. I said, what if I write a fictional book, completely fictional, not you, not Sean, where a mum does do that for her autistic son? And she said that would be amazing because it is such a diverse topic and no one has written about something like that. You know, there are often books about, say, children who are autistic or people who are autistic, but it's not to do with sex and finding love. She said, I would love it if you would write that. And she said, and me and Sean will help you. So it was, you know, it was like setting a challenge. And I thought, oh, my word, can I do this justice? But she was so lovely. And she said, I really think you can. She said, I think you'll be sensitive and we can guide you. And so from there, for about a year, I wrote this book. And as I say, Fiona and Sean read it as I went, and like I said, we acted scenes out, and then when it was done, you know, they maybe told me what needed altering. And in the book, the fictional characters, the mum does hire an escort for her son. That's all I'll say so that I don't ruin it, but you can imagine kind of the fallout that might occur from doing something like this. Yeah.
You mentioned you kind of acted scenes out with them, so they were kind of heavily involved in the process of that, and I guess checking that it feels real, I suppose, and feels true to what that would be like.
Yeah, because Sean's autistic, I wanted to get his voice absolutely right. You know, I didn't want to misrepresent someone on the spectrum, you know, because that would be so unfair. You know, that would not be my place to do that. And so, although I know how he is and how he speaks, obviously to get that on paper and create that character, it just helped. I don't know what it would be is we'd meet and I might say, today I'm writing a scene where the young woman who is the escort, who's called Isabel, she's meeting the character Sebastian, she's meeting him for the first time, they're sitting on the river. Can we just pretend I'm her, you're him? And we just have a conversation and we recorded it, if that makes sense. And then I actually used a lot of the things that we said in the book. And I do maybe feel that's why, I mean, some of the lovely praise that it's had, they've said how true it rings. And I think, well, that's because it came from a very, very true place. Do you know what I mean?
And so did you enjoy that? What sounds like a kind of very sort of active sleeves rolled up process to kind of research and write in a book. Is that more enjoyable than the kind of disappearing off to the study and just dreaming up a story out of nowhere? Which would you prefer if you could do any?
Oh, that's a good question. Do I have to choose?
Or are they just different? Are they just both pleasurable in their own ways?
Both, absolutely that. They're both enjoyable in their own way. I kind of like the challenge that I set myself because I do think, you know, without challenges in our writing, we don't learn anything and we don't improve, do we? I like the challenge that book gave me and I learned a lot. I like the fact that I learned while I was writing that book. I learned, you know, I discovered prejudices that I had. Not just that the world has, but that we all have inbuilt prejudices about things. And I was opened up and learned a lot, which, yes, is completely different to sitting down, as you just described, at a computer and creating a world out of nowhere. That's equally fun and interesting. I suppose it has its own challenges because, yes, you have to create everything. It's not being given to you. Both very different, both very enjoyable.
I would imagine writing can be maybe a slightly lonely process sometimes. Maybe I'm wrong, but the process of having someone else involved to bounce ideas off and then being quite actively involved in the book, I would imagine, does something to kind of help with that process. It sounds challenging, but perhaps quite fun as well.
Yeah, it can be lonely. Obviously, the actual writing is lonely because in order to write a novel in, say, let's say you want to write a novel in 4 months, I personally have to write for about 5 hours every day, Monday to Friday, to write a novel in that length of time. So that's a lot of solitary time, 5 hours at a computer. I mean, I'm lucky that I also work at Hull Truck Theatre, so I do actually have a job. Obviously not this year, it was closed, but in normal life, I had a job where I would meet people, which was good. But I can imagine someone's a full-time writer and it's all they do, you would have to actively make yourself do other things and meet people. But there are lovely book events. I mean, you know, obviously we often do book festivals, book events, and you meet people. I've been on tours and met people. But yeah, essentially the process of writing and editing is solitary. So I think you've got to kind of like your own company or you are not going to want to sit down and probably write, yeah.
So speaking of kind of just making stories up versus basing them on real life stuff, I saw that you'd switched to writing a couple of crime based books. And I'm going to at least assume that you don't have first hand experience of kind of high level crime. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope not.
Less said about that, the better.
But what was behind that to kind of switch genre? Was it just feeling like something different or?
I always write the story that comes to me. And then afterwards, I worry about what genre it is. And the first crimey one that I wrote was called Call Me Stargirl, and it was set in a radio station. And that came to me because I was, before COVID, I was often a guest on Fiona Mills' BBC Radio Homicide show. And when I was there, I often thought how solitary it is on an evening and how spooky when there's just a couple of you in the studio and it's dark outside. And although you've got, you know, thousands of listeners, there's just you. And I had in my head this radio presenter, I just could see her. And I thought, what if it was this radio presenter's last show? And what if it's big on the news that a local woman has been killed in an alley and she was pregnant as well, and it's not been solved? And I thought, and what if someone's ringing the radio station telling this presenter that they know who did it? And what if on her final show, they say that they will tell her who did it. So she makes the theme of the show secrets. So I had all this in my head and I began writing it. And I realised that obviously this was a murder, mystery, crime, whodunit, because there are about four people in the novel that could be the killer. And then obviously, well, I'm not going to say who is, obviously. And so as I'm writing this, I'm realising that this really is different to anything I've written. This is a crime. Psychological thriller is what they're often called these days. But it was such a blast to write and to drop all these little red herrings and have these little twists and cliffhangers. It was genuinely probably the most fun I've ever had writing a book, yeah.
Is it a difficult thing when you've had a degree of success writing a certain kind of fiction to then kind of switch it up? Is there a nervousness that comes with that? Or do you not think about that stuff too much and just write what you want to write?
I do write what I want to write. That is definitely what I do. But yes, every single time, without question, that I've had a book come out, I am always nervous. Doesn't matter how many you have out or how maybe your beta readers say that it's great, you are petrified when it goes out there because you kind of, you know, you're delivering your beloved baby to the world. And obviously it could fail, you know, people might not like it. People might not buy it. So yeah, without fail, every book I've been truly, truly nervous. And I can imagine that I think I always will be. I don't think anyone would ever be so confident to release a book and just think, yeah, that's fabulous, everyone's going to love it. I really don't think, well, maybe there are people like that, I'm not sure, but I'm definitely not one of them.
And kind of touching on something we talked a little bit earlier then, do you read your reviews when the books come out or do you stay clear?
I do read the reviews, not every day and not frequently, because that can, you know, if there are some bad ones, that can be upsetting. But maybe, you know, every other week, once a month, something like that, I will go on Amazon, which is one of the places, and Goodreads is another place. And I will just check them out, because obviously if there are nice ones, that is just heartwarming if you get like a wonderful review about how you know, your book touched someone. But then you do get, you know, the ones, the famous one-star reviews. But some of them are so harsh, they're funny. You know, like I once got one star and it just said the worst book I've ever read. And I actually thought that's almost amazing to be the worst book someone's ever read. You know, like ever. I think that's quite an achievement. I'm quite proud of that. I almost want a glass award saying that. And so what I did one time was to sort of make light of the bad reviews, I created a found poem where I took all the bad reviews I'd got and I made them into like a funny poem, and so many people enjoyed that. So maybe it's time to do another one. I don't know if I've got enough again. I might have enough bad reviews again to do another one. We'll see. But it just cheered me up and made me laugh, and that's the best way to be.
Thanks for listening. We're now available on all the major podcast platforms. Just search for Hull Libraries. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you can get all of the latest episodes as soon as they're out. In the meantime, if you want to check out any of our amazing services at the Hull Libraries, please check out the website hcndel.co.uk/libraries or any of our social media channels. Thanks for listening and see you next time.